Good evening. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder. Welcome to Mind Over Matter, a monthly K2 radio show that explores issues of our minds as well as our hearts. Have you ever wondered why some children thrive and others do not? We've heard the phrase formative years, but do we fully grasp how early childhood experiences affect the health and happiness of the adult the child will become? More and more research is showing that the impact of a child's family environment has profound implications for his or her entire life. Childhood experiences, both positive and negative, have such an impact on people's futures, whether it be the degree of violence they experience, victimization, perpetration, or lifelong health and happiness. Much of the foundational research in this area has been referred to as adverse childhood experiences. And in the show today, we're going to call it ACEs, which is what it's called to the general public. So tonight in the studio, I have with me Alaska's expert on the ACEs research, Pat Skidmore. And welcome to Mind Over Matter, Pat.
Thank you.
We're really lucky to have Pat here because he could give us a three-hour. How long are your workshops usually?
Oh, they vary from short to all day. So
he's going to condense this into 1 hour with a couple of musical breaks. So let's begin and hear more from Pat. Pat, tell me what kind of work you do for the state.
Sure.
And how you became involved in ACEs.
Okay. So I am a planner, a health planner for the Alaska Mental Health Board and the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. They're statewide boards appointed by the governor, and they're tasked with overseeing the behavioral health system, so substance abuse and mental health services in the state. And I'm not a member of the board, but I work for the boards, and they meet together. And it's been about 5 years ago in 2011, we decided to go on a path of looking at adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, here in Alaska. The original research was done about 20 years ago now.
Yeah.
And what happened was that a researcher from Kaiser Permanente, a doctor, who was seeing patients.
And we should explain that that's a health cooperative.
It is.
Bay Area?
It's in San Diego, actually.
San Diego,
was where it
okay.
was. So this medical doctor was treating obese women. And what he found was that the women would often lose a lot of weight quickly, which was the goal of the program, but then they would put it back on equally as fast. And as he began to talk to these women, he found out that having the weight on was a protective factor because many of them had been sexually abused. So this, because he was a good doctor and really did thorough histories with people, he began to ask about their childhoods. And what he started to see clinically was that there seemed to be a link with a tough childhood and some poor health outcomes. So he got together with another researcher at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and they put together a study, and they looked at 17,000 people in that Kaiser Permanente health plan in San Diego, and they asked them about their adverse childhood experiences. So they asked about whether or not they had been sexually abused, physically abused, emotionally abused, whether they were neglected physically or emotionally. And then they had five categories that they called household dysfunction. And that included witnessing domestic violence, going through a separation and divorce, having mental illness in the home, substance abuse in the home, or finally, was someone from the family incarcerated? So as they began to do this research, and I should tell you a little bit about that group, because they were decidedly not a group that you would think would be at risk. They were overwhelmingly Caucasian, mostly college educated or had graduate degrees. Mm. They were an average age of 55, and of course they were in this health plan, so they were fairly wealthy, middle class to upper middle class. And what they found was that adverse childhood experiences were actually quite common in the group. In fact, about two-thirds of that group had at least one of those adverse conditions that they were asked about. And
that means one-third had scores of zero.
One-third had scores of zero, and the rest had at least one.
Probably the biggest one being divorce.
I believe so.
Maybe.
Yes, but actually, what was quite interesting was that, for example, I believe the rate of sexual abuse was about 16%, and Dr. Vince Valletti, who was the doctor in San Diego, is an older man. In fact, he was in Juneau last year. Mm-hmm. When he was in medical school, the rate of sexual abuse he was taught was that it was a 1 in a million. Occurrence. So 16% just is, you know, off the charts. So it stunned them. But the real research began when they started to compare those outcomes of that survey about adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, to the health outcomes. And they started by looking at each individual adverse experience, but then they realized that if you had one adverse experience, you were really likely to have another.
Yeah.
And so they developed what's called an ACE score. And it's kind of a crude measure. It's for each type of adverse experience, you get an ACE score of one. So, for example, if you experienced physical abuse, you had an ACE score of one. If you also experienced a separation and divorce, your ACE score went to two. But when I say it's crude, it doesn't take into consideration how many times you were physically abused.
Or a divorce, for example, might not have the same impact as being sexually abused.
Right. And it didn't take into consideration when this occurred. It was just between birth and their 18th birthday. So even though it was this crude measure, it really is a proxy for stress in childhood. So as they began to look at these ACE scores of these people in San Diego, they were able to compare them to health outcomes. And what they found was that the more ACEs, or adverse experiences, a person had in their childhood, the more likely they were to have all sorts of different negative outcomes. For example, heart disease, cancer, obesity, which is where it all started, depression, of course. Then they looked at things like being the victim of domestic violence, and that actually went up. Also, being a perpetrator of domestic violence went up. So these links began to grow and grow, and it took a while for people to really grasp what they were seeing. And of course, at first they didn't know what the mechanism was to go from this childhood stress or trauma into a health condition or other poor outcome in adulthood. And then they began to look at some of the brain research, and that really started to open the door.
The functional MRI, yeah.
To look at the mechanism of what was going on, and also the stress research and how stress changes our bodies and our brains. And so that was that's been the important part of it. It's not just that we see this, but that there seems to be a mechanism for it. And as Dr. Anda, Rob Anda, who was the researcher from the CDC, has said, that which is predictable is preventable. And so it gives us an opportunity to start to think about how we can prevent these things and potentially change the life course of someone.
Pat, when I was in private practice, I had a video, a DVD that I got from the state of Alaska, like Child and Family Services or something, and it was a dramatic reenactment of an infant in a crib and a mom and dad verbally abusing each other and fighting. The infant may, you know, be in another room even and not understand the words that the parents are using. But the point of the DVD, and the reason I had copies of it is I gave it to clients who had children who were verbally abusive to each other, and because it went into the brain changes that occurred due to that stress. Truly, they had no idea that by yelling and screaming at each other,
right,
that they are harming a supposedly sleeping child in the next room. Whether the point was well made with an infant, because obviously the infant was not thinking, oh, mom and dad are fighting, or they hate me, or it's
right,
my fault, let alone a three-year-old who is really thinking
right,
those thoughts. And it was stunning to people. They had more motivation to protect the brain, because it went into
mm-hmm,
the brain. It didn't just say this harms your child. It showed the brain changes
right,
due to the stress. That gave them more more motivation to stop what they were doing
mm-hmm,
and learn how to communicate in another fashion than if they had not known that information, because then they just would have thought, well, we're only harming ourselves.
Right, right. And I think there's I've seen some other research where they've actually gotten some MRI scans of young children where they're not even actually using words, it's just tone, and they're looking at the brain while the child is listening to either positive or negative tones, and you can see the brain changing or activating in different ways. And so when we think about stress, I mean, there's everyone is going to have stress in their life, and so that's just a given, and learning how to cope with that stress is part of growing up and part of our continuing development as adults. But we're really talking, there's really three kinds of stress that we think about. One is positive stress, and I think about that in terms of, you know, if you're a child and you're in school and, you know, things are going pretty well for you, but you've got a test that day, you're going to have a little stress about it, and that stress is actually going to help you perform a little better. You're going to get some adrenaline or cortisol, which is another hormone that's stressed, and it'll actually boost your performance a little bit, which helps you feel good about yourself and accomplish things and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's really another level of stress, and that's tolerable stress. And we're all going to have bad things happen to us. We're going to lose our grandparents at some point. But if a child is wrapped in a family or community that is supportive, that will buffer that stress,
mm-hmm,
and that will not make that into a brain-changing, body-changing problem. But then there's the third level of stress, which at Harvard they call toxic stress.
Mm.
And that's where a child is just inundated with the stress hormone, cortisol, and they actually adapt to the world. It's very adaptive if they are under stress all the time to change their brains in order to deal with the world in which they live. So
It's very adaptive. That's interesting.
It is adaptive.
And it's adaptive. And, you know, before all this brain research, when I was in grad school and, decades and decades ago,
mm-hmm,
I focused a lot on sexual abuse because I did my dissertation. Research was on teenage prostitution.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the girls that were on the street had been sexually abused. And so the idea simply was, we didn't know the biological basis,
right,
but we absolutely knew that their lives in the future were going to be way more dysfunctional,
mm-hmm,
than if they hadn't been sexually abused, and then further sexually abused, of course, by being on the streets and
right,
under the power of a pimp.
Right,
but we didn't have the biological basis for
right,
that.
Right, and so before we, I agree. Before we go too far into the negative side of this, I will say that hopefully by the end of this we can talk about what can be done, because there are significant things that can be done. So when I think about this, so if you think about a child who's lived in this stressful environment, I always like to use the example. Here in Alaska, you send a child off to preschool. And by the way, the age at which in the United States you're most likely to be expelled from school is age 4. We throw about twice the number of kids out of preschool as we do out of any other age. And so you think about this child who's grown up in a very toxic environment. Their stress system is on edge. and we say, okay, it's time to go outside and play. And imagine this in a preschool. Everybody runs to their cubby to get dressed, right? We got to put on our boots. We got to put on our coats. And invariably, somebody bumps into that child. Well, that child's reaction to that can be different depending on the child, but it's going to be based on their stress response, which is on edge. And so they may fight, which is one of the stress responses, fight, flight, or freeze. And so you'll see children in school or in child care use one of those methods. And actually, the one that's easiest to miss is freeze. Because if a child is frozen, sitting in school, they're not really going to be causing a problem. But they're really not going to be learning either, because their stress system is on edge. And so if you think about our stress system like a road, when we're just kind of doing what we need to do, we go through life, we're walking down the road, we're observing what's going on, we're making plans, and then we're acting on those plans. If for example, we're out in Juneau walking up Perseverance Trail and we round the bend and there's a bear, we have a stress response, right? And that doesn't entail a great deal of planning and thinking and then executing. There's kind of a reaction that happens. We can use fight, flight, or freeze depending on the situation. Now, normally we'll just back off, which is a form of flight, and that works. And then we get back on the trail and we go through our lives. But if you think about a child who's been under toxic stress, it's like having that bear in the trail all the time. You know, so that off-ramp or that system that we have, instead of being just an occasional thing when we're really in danger, it becomes the route we take for almost everything. So it's really easy to put a child like that into their stress response, which at home, if it's not safe, works. But when they go to school or go out into the community, it doesn't work, and it causes them problems. And so raising the awareness about this, and then when we think about how common it was in people, two-thirds of those people in San Diego, then we start to think, well, what's going on in Alaska? And so our boards decided in 2012 to make a request to go after and look at the data for Alaskan adults about what sort of adverse childhood experiences they've had.
I'm very interested in that.
So each year there's a health survey. It's called the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System. It's done in every state. It's done by the CDC. And we ask Alaskan adults about what had happened prior to their 18th birthday. And we did that in 2013, 14, and 15. So we have those data now. And they're fascinating. I mean, just like the people in San Diego, the more adverse childhood experiences you have, the more likely you are to smoke, the more likely you are to have obesity, the more likely you are to have asthma. Just very similar to what those other studies have shown. And I will say that the ACE study has been replicated more than 600 times across the globe. It is not unique to any group. It happens.
So it's part of the human condition. It's not cultural. So whether you're Native American, African American, it's the same.
It is the same.
Harm done to children harms their brains and harms them throughout their life.
Right. And so we looked at it, and some interesting things as we began to delve into the data came out. And so because other states have also done this, there are no national rates of adverse childhood experiences, although there's a bill in the Senate right now in the U.S. Senate to capture those rates. But when we look at other states, we see that Alaska really has higher rates of adverse childhood experiences in our adult population than almost virtually than all the other states.
Oh.
But an interesting thing when we looked at it and when we compared generational differences. So, for example, when we looked at our adults from 18 to 35 and compared them to adults in other states 18 to 35, our rates were comparable. But when we looked at adults in the older age groups, 45 and up, what we found was that's where we were higher. So we're actually holding our adverse childhood experiences, at least relative to those other states, our higher rates in our older population.
Ah, do you have any sense of why that might be?
Well, I'd like to say that it's the work of the Alaska Mental Health Board and the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse and all our partners. But I think there's a number of things going on. You really start to see a change when oil money starts to come in. So you think about we've got an influx of people. So probably some in-migration is part of that. You also get social services that didn't exist before in greater numbers. We start to have a safety net and better behavioral health services, substance abuse and mental health, and just more supports for families. So I suspect it's probably a combination of all those things, but it's really hard to tease out in the data. But clearly something is going on, and it holds up in the Alaska Native population too. So that indicates to me that there's definitely services are making a difference.
Okay, and I really want to connect on some special population groups like
sure.
Alaska Natives, and then in a national study, blacks compared to whites, mm-hmm. and then military families, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But I think this is a perfect moment to take a music break. If you have just joined us, I am talking with Pat Sidmore from the State of Alaska Mental Health Board, and we're looking at the influence of adverse childhood life experiences on a person's entire life. So let's take a short musical break, and then Pat and I will be back to talk some more about the Alaska specific and group specific aspects of the ACEs research. Welcome back. You're listening to Mind Over Matter, and I am Dr. Elaine Schroeder. And with me in the studio tonight is Pat Sidmore from the State of Alaska Mental Health Board. We've been talking about some very important research focusing on the impact of a harmful environment on a child's lifelong physical and mental health. So, Pat, I'd like to take a look at some groups or issues like poverty, racism, and things like that. I just read a detailed article about the significantly higher incidence of poor pregnancy outcomes for black women in the U.S. compared to white women. And what was interesting, even controlling for education and income, they had more miscarriages, lower birth weight, all sorts of things. Black women are almost four times more likely to die from pregnancy complications than white women. And black babies are twice as likely to die before their first birthday as white babies. So let's take a look at just that one aspect of health, which is maternal maternal health. And the article went into some discussion. It wasn't a purely scientific article. It was an article really about racism and the stress that racism puts on the human body.
Right.
And being black in America post-slavery and the stress of that. And so the author was using the data from the CDC, Center for Disease Control, to really make her point that just being X, whether it's Muslim, Native American, brown, Latino, or black, causes stress. And interestingly, they didn't mention ACEs, but they could have tied it in. So could you give me some thoughts on blackness in America and what the ACEs say about that?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple things. One is there happens to be another survey that was done with children that used a different set of ACEs from the original with the adults. And one of the factors they asked caregivers, mostly mothers of children, was whether or not their child had been exposed to racism or bigotry, either one. And so there was recognition that that is a stressor that is equal to some of the other stressors that we talked about, such as living in a home with mental illness or
very good. Yeah.
So there's that. And I think when we look at Alaska's data, the African Americans adults have the highest rate of having four or more ACEs in our state of biracial groups, but interestingly, when we start to look at some of the different groups, women in Alaska have higher rates of ACEs than men do, mostly across the board. There's some interesting takes on that. Sexual abuse is significantly higher for women.
That makes sense.
Which makes sense. They also seem to report higher rates of mental illness in the home, which I don't know whether that may just be some recognition that's different between the genders.
Yeah.
So that's kind of interesting. When we look also at the LGBT community, they those children are exposed to more adversity as children as well. And so you know, there are a number of groups, and certainly poverty plays a role in the National Survey of Children's Health. Poverty was another ACE that they added into the mix.
That's what I would think.
And interesting, the third one that I think that was really important was neighborhood violence that really seemed to pop out in the data, even here in Alaska, that if you live in a neighborhood that's violent, you're really likely to have a number of other ACEs, and it has an impact on your health.
Well, you've heard of gentrification. Well, I lived in the opposite. I grew up on the south side of Chicago. And when I grew up, everything was nonviolent, pleasant, and easy. No stress. It was a reasonably normal stress-free inner city. It but a different sense of inner city.
Right.
It was working class. It wasn't poverty.
Right.
And then the neighborhood went very, very poor. And the gentry, known as the people who could afford it, moved to the suburbs.
Sure.
And the violence began.
Sure. And so I think that when we look at this, again, it's just really important to think about it in terms of stress. And so your point about racism or poverty, it's really about the stress that those children are growing up in. And so I going back to my earlier road metaphor or trail metaphor, where your reaction when you run into that bear on Perseverance Trail and you get that burst of cortisol, that stress hormone, and your heart rate goes up and your blood pressure goes up and everything. Well, again, imagine if your stress response is such that that's kind of the norm. And then think about what it was like to be a kid to learn long division. And imagine trying to learn long division when there's a bear right there. That's the way to think about a child who's been experiencing toxic stress. So there's significant work being done around the state with this concept of trauma-informed schools.
Oh, tell me about that.
So a trauma-informed school, there's really a process that goes into it, and it starts with trauma awareness. So it's starting with this discussion that we're having about ACEs and realizing how common childhood stress is, and then moving into a sensitivity, and then finally into a trauma-informed practice. So it's the ability to recognize that a child's behavior may not actually be this defiant thing that certainly when I went through my elementary ed teaching program, I wasn't taught anything about this. Bad behavior was bad behavior.
Yeah.
We didn't really look at why that behavior was going on. And now when we think of it in terms of stress, if a child has witnessed the violence in their home that morning, and then they go to school and they can't focus, well, that's pretty reasonable, actually.
That's interesting what you're doing, because the first level, you could think, well, you'll teach the teachers techniques on how to deal with kids with high A scores. But the other thing is, it's compassion. Because I gave a lot of training on child sexual abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked with foster parents.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of behaviors that a foster child will exhibit, a female foster child particularly, who has a history of sexual abuse, will be very obnoxious.
Mm-hmm.
They can be sexualized, they can flirt with the dad, they can do all these kinds of things, which if you have no... Once I worked with the foster parents, and they had a feeling that these were normal symptoms,
right,
that the child was actually a victim, not a perpetrator at this point. They
right.
were a victim, and these were normal reactions to abuse.
Right.
And so that develops compassion, and they saw it completely differently.
Right. Right. And that's the start of being trauma informed. And it doesn't just have to be in the schools. I know, for example, Zach Gordon Youth Center here in Juneau is training their staff on this. And so it becomes a way of seeing the world, because trauma, again, is so common, and we can point to our data here in Alaska and see that it is, that we change the lens, we change the lens with which we look at behavior in children, and that can actually lead to some significant changes in how we respond to them. We were looking at some data from the Department of Education, and last year there were 20,000 suspensions from schools in Alaska, and more than half of them were related to this concept of defiance or willful disobedience is how they were labeled. And so you think about, what does that mean? Well, of course it's unique in each case, but most children, are behaving that way for a reason, and that doesn't mean that we let them get away with everything. That school needs to be a safe place for everyone, But we have to filter that behavior through the lens of what's going on. And in trauma work, there's a shift that goes something like this. It's condensed into, we change from saying what's wrong with you to what happened to you. Mm. And so, you know, so we ask a kid when they blow up in class, what's going on, rather than, you know, stop that, you know, or, you know.
Oh.
So it becomes this change in paradigm that.
So now you talk to the child. It's just very different. What's going on, honey?
Right.
What's happening?
Right. I'm a social worker, but that's not a social worky thing. That's really driven by research. There was some tremendous research that's come out of Duke University, where the Administration for Children and Families at the federal level asked them to decide or asked them to do a literature review of all the scientific work around trauma. And after looking at more than 400 journal articles, they came back with, you know, here's what, if there's one thing to focus on, we need to help children self-regulate.
Ah.
And self-regulation is an interesting term. It can mean a lot of different things, but one of the best measures I like are really three things. One is, can a child persevere when things are tough? So can they, you know, kind of hang in there and get through it? Can they stay calm? Can they regulate their emotions? Can they manage their emotions? And then the third is, are they curious? Are they engaged with the world? And if what the research showed is that if we can build that into children, even if they have trauma in their past, some of the or many of the health and other problems that are associated with a poor childhood can be mitigated, which is tremendously hopeful. And that's why we have to change about the way we deal with traumatized children, because there's really one way to learn that, and that's we all learn that, how to self-regulate, how to manage our emotions, how to have a positive view of the world through relationships.
Exactly. And if a kid, so, you know, just to play the devil's advocate, if a kid is home most of the time, well, actually, it has me think of why Head Start is so great. Mm-hmm. Because if a child is in a violent, angry home, it's really better for them to be in a preschool a couple of hours a day, mm-hmm. you know,
right.
than at home, where, right. you know, normally we think, well, you know, it's great if the kid could stay home and the mom doesn't go to work or something.
Right.
So so you've got trauma-informed schools. Well, how do you teach a child to self-regulate when they go home
right.
to adults who are yelling and screaming and don't have any control over their emotions?
Right. And so I think you're exactly right about we try to maximize that time where a child is in a healthy environment.
Yeah.
But we really have to approach this as a two-generation solution. We can't just focus on the children. We have to support families. And one of the things when we looked at, we've been exploring the National Survey of Children's Health, where we looked at ACEs in the Alaska kids. And what we found was that our 17-year-olds, when they were ready to go into adulthood, had 1.3 adverse childhood experiences on average. And the age at which our kids had half of that, or 6.65 mm-hmm. ACEs per average, was age 3.
So they get most of the harm
early.
Yeah, and which is so terrible. And you know, in the research I've read, and it's been a while, so my research mm-hmm. isn't up to date on the impact of child sexual abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Very much, I remember back in the old days, and tell mm-hmm. me if what's current. Two important factors
mm-hmm.
Affected the damage that was done mm-hmm. by child sexual abuse: the age,
mm-hmm.
the
mm-hmm.
younger, the worse it was, mm-hmm. and whether the mother believed him.
Mm-hmm. There's some interesting research by Martin Teicher at Harvard on the brain, and it seems like there are some critical times
yes.
when it occurs that it's not necessarily young, you know, I mean, there may
yeah.
be some
critical times.
Critical times
of brain growth
of impact on the brain if the sexual abuse happens at a certain time, but I think kind of jumping back to that earlier thing because
yeah.
I think that's important. We invest almost no money in early childhood in our state, in our country. Other countries have figured this out, and supporting families of newborns for extended amounts of time
yeah.
is probably really smart. And there's actually an economist at the University of Chicago. His name is James Heckman, and he's a Nobel laureate. He's won the Nobel Prize in economics. And he's shown that early intervention pays off about 13%. So imagine your income or your retirement earning 13% a year. I would take that. And that's what an investment in quality early childhood programs pays off for us annually. And so, you know, that's the kind of policy decisions we have to make. And I was just sitting in a meeting today where an epidemiologist for the state, Jared Parrish, was showing that he's been following a cohort of children who were born beginning in 2009. So they're six, 7 years old now, and multiple years. And anyway, so what we've learned from this very representative sample of more than 3,000 kids is that by age seven, one out of three Alaskan children will have a report of harm to the Office of Children's Services.
Oh, my gosh.
One out of three. And that one out of 12 will have that report of harm substantiated. So about 9%, 8 to 9% of the kids will have a report of harm substantiated. Well, this matters. I mean, this is we know just in terms of the human cost, as we've been talking about, in terms of health and life course, it's devastating. But we're also talking about real money. When one of the things that we did at the boards was when we looked at the adult data, we examined some of the economic costs. And what we determined using this epidemiological idea of population attributable risk, which is really a pretty simple idea. It's like if you think about smoking and lung cancer. So the idea is what percentage of lung cancer would go away if we eliminated all smoking. So what we looked at is what percentage of six different things would go away if we could eliminate all ACEs in our population. And what we found was that for adult Medicaid, there would be 40% fewer adults using Medicaid if we had eliminated all ACEs during their childhood, which is $350 million a year. So it's not realistic to eliminate all that. But to take a little bite out of that, to try to spend some money reducing that, is going to pay enormously, and that's just Medicaid. Then in that same study, we also look at obesity savings, at smoking, you know, at other things. It's like compound interest. If you can stop it early, you can really change the life course of someone, and they're more productive. Obviously, in human terms, it's infinitely better, but in financial terms, it is as well.
You know, Pat, I've often thought, as a psychotherapist, working with people who have suffered so much because of poverty, racism, mm-hmm. And lack of services.
Mm-hmm.
I used to live in France, and I go back mm-hmm. every 2 years and stay for about a month. And I have friends there, and one of them is a preschool teacher. And preschool is free and universally available to all French children.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget from what age, maybe two. And so I know a preschool teacher, and she has a master's in early childhood education. She's the head teacher. All her teachers have a bachelor equivalent, a bachelor degree, mm-hmm. bachelor's degree in early childhood education. They work for the government. Mm-hmm. Therefore, they have adequate salaries. They have the same salary as a high school teacher.
Right.
It is seen as no different. Then, of course, there's universal health care. Then, of course, in the social democracies of Europe, from Sweden to Spain mm-hmm. and Portugal, the difference in income between people, there's much mm-hmm. more income equality mm-hmm. Compared to the United States. In fact, there's a huge difference in measures of income mm-hmm. Equality or inequality compared to the social democracies in Europe. And, you know, now we're hearing talk about Medicare for all and how we need universal health care when, of course, we're going in completely the opposite direction mm-hmm. and putting money into war and military over social services and education. So what I would feel, and it would be very interesting to maybe you know it, if we took a look at countries like Denmark or Sweden or mm-hmm. France or Germany and really took a look at ACE scores, mm-hmm. do you know the difference in ACE scores between Europe and the U.S.?
You know, I know there have been some. I don't know them off the top of my head. I think that what becomes interesting when you look at a model like Europe is again how they budget and how they spend their money around health. So because they look at health universally and they look at it for everyone and they know what it costs, they're able to see the benefits of other things, and I think that's why they have the early childhood
right.
programs, because they're able...
It's not a profit-making system.
Right.
They, in fact, want to keep costs down.
Right, and that's what they do. That's why their healthcare systems are cheaper, because they're able to see the big picture where we have it all in different chunks and different piles of money and programs, so we don't really
it's
look
chaotic.
At
it's
we
totally
don't look
chaotic.
At it as a whole.
And I remember when a researcher came here and spoke, I think to the Juno World Affairs Council. He had researched the different healthcare systems in the developed world, in the industrialized world. Every other country, of course, has universal healthcare. We're the one exception, which makes us very exceptionally uncompassionate, I would say.
Right.
And, you know, looking at the data for health outcomes, maternal death rate, all the stuff, you know, we were talking about, you know, if you have a baby in France, you stay in the hospital for several days.
Right.
You're not kicked out. And then immediately you have visiting nurses
right.
to prevent and to identify. I know there's a program here, but these are piecemeal
right.
where they identify maybe the half of 1%. Doctor may call in the special service. You must know about it. I don't know what it's called, yes. where they identify at-risk mothers.
Right.
But it's some small program that's probably going to be cut because we've got a budget deficit.
Well, I think that, you know, I think that, for example, when I mentioned earlier today that we were looking at this data where one out of three, you know, by age seven, Alaska children had a report of harm. And then we also then, because this group is looking at it, we also then took a look at the percentage of birth to five-year-olds, for example, that ever received mental health services. And it's virtually none through the Medicaid system. And you would expect, given that many kids are experiencing that, their behaviors would lead them to a mental health center. But we don't see it because of the way our system is set up. And again, so there are efforts around ACEs to really try to bring this home so that it's a system that responds to people's needs and frankly heads off problems rather than waits until they become acute. When we look at teenagers, for example, that go into residential programs, I think this was a topic in the legislature this session, they're incredibly expensive
yes.
programs where we see we see some of the work that's being done at the Alaska Trauma Center in Anchorage, which I mentioned to you the other day, is people may not realize this, but we have a world-class trauma center in Anchorage.
You mean psychological trauma?
It is. It's a child trauma. It's a emotional trauma. They primarily work with children coming into the protective services. But they are they do amazing work with helping children get back on track, which actually helps reunite them with parents who are struggling, because if the child's back on track and the parents are improving, if the child's in a better place, they're more likely to be able to go back with the parents, because they may not be completely back on track, but if the child's behaving and has dealt with some of the trauma, it's more likely they can get back with their families, which if it's a healthy thing, can really be very positive, rather than taking them out of the family and putting them in foster care or adopting them out, which for some kids is the best solution. But getting that child back on track at age five.
Through a residential program?
No, through outpatient programs. Mm. So actually getting that child back on track at five is significantly cheaper than waiting until they're in the juvenile justice system or have to go to residential when they're 14. And then we get into the situation where they're trying to become adults and they don't have family support. And, it's just hard. Mm-hmm.
Are there any, let's say that you do have a child who is adopted, mm-hmm. or who is in foster care, and you're working with the adoptive or foster parents of a very troubled child. Are there trauma-informed parenting classes?
There are. The Office of Children's Services, excuse me, and the university help with this, and again, the trauma center has some training called Trauma 101 that works with behavioral health providers, mental health, and substance abuse providers. So our skill level in the state is expanding around trauma, and it really has been for 10 years. And you have to give credit to the Division of Behavioral Health. They really have been working on this very quietly. Low to the ground, trying to build it out. I was just presenting with Josh Arvidson, who founded the Child Trauma Center last week, and he said he and his team have spoken to 31,000 Alaskans about
this.
Is
it a public-private, or is
it's
it...
It's a branch of Anchorage Community Mental Health.
So it's a city, Anchorage City funded.
It's a nonprofit.
It's a nonprofit. It's not directly part of the state of Alaska.
No, they receive grants from the state. They bill Medicaid, and they also, because of their quality, get national grants.
Well, how wonderful to know that, but they're so far away.
They are. But I know that they're planning, they're working with Juno Youth Services to do a training called Trauma 101 in town. I haven't seen the dates yet on that. But I think there are a number of efforts around Juno right now through Rock Juno, which is raising our kids with kindness.
What's that?
So it's a group that has formed. It's interesting. It sprang out of the Suicide Prevention Council, actually.
Oh.
And their work.
Huh.
It's different in each community where it sprung up. In the Mat-Su, it came out of their health foundation. They have a Rock Mat-Su.
Hmm.
And the groups have really kind of focused on child trauma with the idea of improving the health of the community.
This is the polar opposite of tough love movement, isn't it?
It is. When you think about the schools, we went through this period of, kind of zero tolerance.
Yeah.
And that's where we're throwing kids out of school. And I think we're coming around to maybe that's not the solution. Maybe that's just re-traumatizing kids. And, again, that's not to say that we don't hold kids accountable. There's this idea of in juvenile justice called restorative justice, and restorative practice in schools, where a child may go back and apologize for the behavior, but there's some recognition of where that behavior comes from.
Well, you're really talking in a very different paradigm from the tough love and law and order point of view, where restorative justice, the ROC program, is really scientifically based.
Right.
And the tough love stuff is not.
Right.
And it really more comes out of an authoritarian style. And, you know, to use comparisons again between, say, Europe, where there's far less violence. I mean, we know the U.S., because of guns and many cultural factors, is the most violent industrialized country in the world, where the prison systems in Northern Europe are much more based on a philosophy of rehabilitation and education rather than suffering and punishment.
Right. It's definitely a different paradigm. And I think, you know, when we look at things like trauma-informed schools, what we're seeing is we're actually, as the data comes in, we're seeing that those suspensions and expulsions are dropping, which leads to more instruction time. So we're actually seeing increased academic scores.
Sure, of course, because the example you gave, I mean, if you just haven't slept all night because your parents were screaming, how can you study algebra?
Right, and here's the other thing that I think is really important too, because you'll see this in reports, especially about early childhood programs. And James Heckman, the Nobel laureate that I talked about, makes this point. So in some of the early childhood, like preschools, you'll see a boost for children academically, and then you'll see that academic boost fade. But what doesn't fade is what he calls the soft skills, which is that self-regulation piece that I talked about earlier. What doesn't fade is the ability to stay calm, the ability to follow through, the ability to stay curious if they're in a quality program. And guess what that leads to? High school graduation, better jobs, less crime. And so yeah, we may not have the same, you know, reading scores may fall off, but those other skills, again, sometimes it depends on the crowd he's talking to. Sometimes he calls that character, which is fine.
Yeah.
But it's really about those skills we need to get up every day, go to work, take care of our families, you know, be in relationships.
Well, character is a good word for it.
Yeah. It works fine.
Yeah, it works fine because it's really the foundation of what makes a good life. Right. And that is a beautiful point on which to end. And I really thank you. I want to thank Pat Sidmore for sharing his expertise and knowledge about the impact of harmful family environments on children's whole lives, even as they go into adulthood. And I want to thank also my loyal technicians, John and Dolly Kremers, who, besides biking all over the world and speaking several languages, are the master technicians who assisted me this evening. And good night to all our Southeast Alaska listeners. So please, folks, tune in on another Monday next month at 7 p.m. to KTOO for another edition of Mind Over Matter. Thank you, Pat, again, and good night to all of you out there.